From the KBIA newsroom in Columbia, this is Intersection, Conversations in Our Community. I'm Sarah Shariari. There are 28 urban search and rescue teams in the United States, and the only Missouri team is based right here in Boone County. It's called Missouri Task Force One, and it's managed by the Boone County Fire Protection District. This all-volunteer group includes firefighters, doctors, engineers, canine search specialists, and many others from all over the state, plus thousands of pounds of gear and equipment. Recently, a Missouri Task Force One team deployed to Texas to aid local agencies responding to flooding and destruction caused by Hurricane Harvey. Task Force members Terry Castle and Danny Mueller joined me in the studio to talk about that work. We started with Danny telling us what it was like to get all those people and all that gear on the road on short notice. When you got the call that you were going to go down to Texas for Harvey, how does that day go? I imagine it's just like a tremendous push to get everything out the door.
And it was at the end of the day for
us. It was at the end of the day.
Yeah. So the fire chief called around 10:30 at night. So I had to go wake up my wife and tell her, hey, we're getting ready to go. So it was a scramble at home just to get to the district office where everything was already happening. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole bunch of people that aren't on the deployment roster that are coming in, helping, doing support role stuff, getting all the logistics and all of our cash, all the equipment stuff that we needed to have ready to get out the door. So all the trucks were prepped and people were prepped. And it's a big undertaking. It takes a whole bunch of hands. And it's pretty neat to see all the wheels in motion.
And you take a couple of tractor trailers down, and do you also have stuff flown down as well?
Well, we took Type 1 cache. That's three tractor trailers mm-hmm. that went along. And then I think we had four F-450s pulling gooseneck trailers that are 32 feet long.
Wow.
There are 11 vehicles in total in our caravan. And one of those is a Greyhound bus that carries the vast majority of our team members have to ride on a bus. So to move 50 people down the road and over 100,000 pounds of equipment to sustain us is a big undertaking just in itself, just to move that many people from here to San Antonio where we first stopped.
And you're going with enough things to be self-sufficient for 72 hours. And I imagine in this case you're taking boats, you're taking medical equipment. It's just a tremendous amount of stuff to go into that situation and help.
Everything it takes to sustain us. We don't want to be a burden on the community that we've come to help. Our motto is you're either part of the solution or you're part of the problem. And if we show up to help you and then we have to ask you for something, well, we're not part of the solution, then we're part of the problem. We don't want to be part of the problem. So we're self-sustaining for at least 72 hours. And then after that, we have to start looking back for logistical help to start taking care of the team as far as food and water and that sort of thing.
So you have to keep your supply chain coming in too.
Correct.
Then. And so you get to San Antonio and you don't, you know, manage any response. You're there to help where they need you to help. So do you go to the fire chief there and ask what to do?
When we got to San Antonio, they had a staging area at the AT&T Center, which is where the San Antonio Spurs play basketball. And that's where they stage teams. We were there for one day. Short night. We didn't get in bed until almost 3 o'clock in the morning. They got us up at like 5 or 6. That afternoon we left. They told us to leave and head for Robstown, which is just outside Corpus Christi. And that's where the real wind part of this storm really hit, was on that western side. And we got bunked down there around midnight to 1 o'clock in the morning. We were wheels up at 5:30 the next morning to go to Rockport, Texas. And you might have seen Rockport on television in some of the reports. Rockport was just the little town that I would just say there was not a single building that we saw that was not affected. Mm-hmm. Some just had some roof damage. Others were just decimated. So that town was really heavily hit. They were 100% without of electricity, no water system up and running. They were running the police department on generator. And we were told that when we encountered citizens, we would tell them to evacuate, go to the police department. If they couldn't self-evacuate, to go to the police department, and they were going to ship them out of town, and don't come back until we tell you to come back. So that little town was really decimated. So we usually hook up with a local person. We can't just go in and take over a community. That's mm-hmm. not what we're there to do. We're there to assist them. So we're either hooked up with a sheriff. We're hooked up with a fire department many times, a local emergency management director. That's our point of contact, and we work with those locals to do our job.
And can you describe to me a little bit, Danny, what this town looked like? What was the scene when you arrived in it?
It looked like a tornado just went through. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's more of the local perspective because we can't imagine hurricanes here. But
right.
It wiped this town out. And like Terry said, it was just annihilated.
Almost like Joplin looked yeah. to us. Mm. Almost like Joplin.
And the width of the storm was tremendous. I mean, it covered so much area, you know, with not only wind but rain and water, and it was just spread out so far that it was hard to get your hands around it for the locals. So that's where we came in, and all the other task forces around the country came to support all of that. So,
are you seeing like trees that have been split?
Oh, completely.
And torn up, homes without roofs, homes filled with water.
Homes destroyed. Mm-hmm. Yeah, in that area, that Rockport area was where the eye actually went through. Mm. So. There wasn't a whole lot of water standing, but it was wind. So it knocked everything off. So houses were off, foundations were completely destroyed, and trees gone. And from what I understand, it was a pretty nice community beforehand, mm-hmm. and it was just annihilated.
And there you found people still there who had stayed throughout the storm?
Yeah, there were still folks there, still locals there that were just – folks are just walking around in the street. They were just it was like they were lost, you know. And you just can't imagine the stress level that must be going on with those folks to get through. Number one, to make it through the storm,
right.
And then secondly, to just look around and say everything you have is just gone, just mm-hmm. decimated. So it was just a very humbling and bewildering feeling for us, a helpless feeling. Because yes, we could give them a little bit of help to get them to the police station, get them in buses, and get them out of there so they could get to shelters, but. Long term, they need long term help. So it we can give a little help, but what they needed was long term things.
So your job when you get there is to sort of find these people and get them to the place where they can get help, get out.
We're given a mission, and we're usually given an area to work in, and then whatever our mission is. Sometimes our mission is there's a building that's collapsed, and we believe there are people inside that mm-hmm. building. And then we use our engineers and folks to tell us the safest way to get into that building, and we have the equipment to get through that building and get through that rubble to bring those people out. Other times it's we don't know how many people are here, how many are missing, so we do wide area searches. So we basically walk the streets, check each house, do wellness checks, check on people. Are you okay? Are you staying? You need to get out, those sorts of things. And we check. We make we do data checks with our GPSs, our handheld GPSs, and then we can bring that information back and feed it into their GIS people, and we can show that we checked this grid. This grid's been checked, and this is how many people are here. Then the next other teams may be checking other areas. So it just depends on what the mission we're giving when we get there.
And in this case, in this town, it sounds really surreal to walk through this and try to find people or to go into a building and not know if you're going to find anybody and what condition they're going to be in. How do you approach that? It sounds really harrowing.
Yeah, you have to have the right mindset for it. And I think, you know, since the majority of us come from a fire-related background, we deal with a lot of this stuff on a day-to-day basis. So although the circumstances are different and the surroundings are different, our objectives and our missions are the same. So even in town, if somebody gets in a car wreck, we know that we're there for patient care and to take care of the people that are in that vehicle so they can get to the hospital and get definitive care. But same kind of deal when we're dealing with a collapsed building or somebody who's trapped in a flood or whatever the case may be. We need to fix their problem and get them to the best case scenario or get them to a solution.
Yeah, you're in that headspace where you're going to address the problem and
right.
then go on to the next
yeah,
problem.
Yeah, we are definitely a group of problem solvers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it's really neat being around a whole bunch of type A personality folks. That's our goal is to be a problem solver and fix whatever needs to happen. And we get really antsy when we're tied up, you know. So.
This is Intersection on KBIA. I'm Sarah Shariari. Today we're talking with Missouri Task Force One members Terry Castle and Danny Mueller about the task force's work in Texas following Hurricane Harvey. Danny and then Terry shared some of the memories from Texas that will stick with them. Do you have a memory of like a person you encountered and helped out while you were in Texas?
There were several. The most impactful day we had in Texas was in the Katy area, and we ended up getting approximately 400 people out on boats that day. So they were very grateful. And that was I think the thing that I'll take home – that I took home most out of that whole entire trip was really wasn't that day, but it was a day later when we did GPS work. We were basically doing wellness checks in a neighborhood that was affected, and they had approximately 6 to 8 feet of water inside their home. So most of them had already gotten out or they got to higher elevation. So when we were doing wellness checks, we're walking down the street, and all these people had all their belongings sitting on the curb of their house, and they were pulling sheetrock out of their house, and everything they owned was sitting on the street. And when we'd go up to them and say, hey, do you guys need anything? Can we help you out? They'd say, no, but can we get you some water or do you want some food? And it was just, it just hit you, you know, and you're like, holy cow, these people just lost everything. And they're worried about me having water.
Yeah.
And that's what I'll take away from that the most, I think.
It's like really affirming of human nature in that way.
Holy cow. Yeah.
And it didn't matter the neighborhood you were in, whether it was a very affluent neighborhood or it was not an affluent neighborhood, the mindset of the people was the same. They were very grateful people. I got that same exact thing. We never cross word. One lady asked me, where have you been? Why, you should have been here 3 days ago. And I said, ma'am, I drove almost 1,400 miles to get here, and I haven't really been to sleep since Thursday. And she's like, I'm sorry I even asked. I'm like, it's okay. And she goes, well, thanks for coming. I'm like, well, you would have done the same for us. And you were asking about things of impact. One day these guys were doing – I'm a safety officer, so I'm not in the boats. But these guys were in boats one day, and they went to a house in the Katy area. And there was a house, and they were actually running a generator. Mm-hmm. And a generator was running inside the house. I went to extract those folks and get them out of there and get them to an ambulance and get them off to the hospital. And to me, that was a true – I mean, we call them all rescues when we go get someone out of a house and bring them out. But that was a true life save because those people would have gone to sleep and they would have never woke up. So that was the one that really stuck out to me that we really, really saved those people's lives that day. Those other folks, they may have been there. Yep, the next day, yeah, the water would have been up in the house. They probably would have been fine. We think so. But those two, those people we got out of that house, that was definite. Those were definite life saves.
Because the generator emits carbon monoxide.
Exactly. It emits lots of carbon monoxide, and those folks would have perished in that house. And folks did in Florida and different areas. Every time there's one of these disasters, there are people who perish because generators run in buildings. People are afraid people will steal them and everything else. So they put them inside. They put them on the back porch. They put them on the deck, wherever. And they're not ventilated correctly. Mm-hmm. And those fumes get inside the house, and those people die.
It
happened in this event, this chain of storms also with Harvey and Irma. It happened also. So, you know, that was true life saves. That's the one thing that really stuck out to me, that we really honestly saved those people's life that day. So.
And so your team was in San Antonio, and then you went to Rockport, is it?
Then we went to Rockport, and then after Rockport, we went to Katy, and that's where we spent the majority of the time after that. And we got deployed to different areas.
Katy's a subdivision of Houston, Texas. Mm-hmm. It's
just west of Houston.
And that area sounds like it was significantly flooded to the extent that you needed to do boat extractions. Mm.
So, yeah, the Houston area was just a huge rain event. Mm-hmm. So they didn't have lots of trees knocked down and buildings torn up and power lines down. It was just a huge 50-inch rain event. In fact, the evening that we arrived in Katy, Texas, we got 7.1 inches of rain in 1 hour.
Mm.
And I was trying to explain to my wife what it felt like. And I was like, it would be like if you got in the shower and there were 5 shower heads running on you all the time. That's sort of how
it
felt.
And it didn't stop for
and
hours.
It just didn't stop.
And
it was just days of rain. So I don't know. It was kind of hard to explain. I've never been in a rain situation where, you know, here we have thunderstorms. So there's thunder and there's lightning and there's wind and then it rains and then it blows through.
Right.
There, we never saw lightning. We never saw thunder or never heard thunder. It just – the wind blew and it rained. And then sometimes the wind blew harder and it rained harder. That's just what it was for days. And it was just – it's just a really amazing event.
I feel like that would make me feel like I was going crazy just being like pounded on with rain for that long.
Yeah. You don't really think about it.
Yeah.
I mean, although it's, you know, around you all the time, you just –
Yeah, the task at hand takes over the weather event. We don't pay a lot of attention to that. We were already wet, so it didn't matter.
One of the things I always think of when I see people wading through these streets up to their waists in water is, what is in that water? You know, is there electricity? Is there sewage? Like, it's just
all
such a
above.
Very
yes
dangerous
is the answer
situation,
to all of that.
Right?
Yeah.
Yes is the answer.
When you're going into these people's homes and they're flooded, how were you finding people? Like, how had they sort of taken refuge in the homes?
It really depended on the house. So obviously the terrains in the neighborhoods, some folks were a little higher up in the neighborhood and some were unfortunately a lot lower. But the majority of them, we had several towards the end of the day because the water levels continued to rise, that they were up on their stairwell.
Mm-hmm.
So most of them sought refuge on a second story. And fortunately, that neighborhood in particular was all two-story homes. So that was great. They didn't have to go up in an attic or anything like that. They were at least safe, from the elements more or less. But we did have some challenges. I mean, we had a gentleman who had a recent hip surgery and couldn't get his leg wet at all. So we had to get creative just to get him from a second story out to the boat that we had out. So we basically took his island for his kitchen and floated him out. We four-pointed him and floated him out under the boat just to keep him dry. But just like you said, with the water being so nasty and full of anything imaginable, we didn't want to risk it with him.
Infections.
And then he's in bad shape, you know, to begin with. So
that's what I was thinking. You know, if you have your health and you're not dealing with any very elderly people or any very young people, like, you probably just go to the second floor of your house and you tough it out. But if you have anybody with any sort of medical situation or a small child, I can't imagine how stressful and desperate that situation must seem.
And, you know, a lot of people would tough it out. They thought they would tough it out, but then they didn't think about, okay, well, what if I'm without power for X amount of days and this water level continues to rise? And they were letting dams out at various points in the day. So it was really uncertain on whether they were going to get even more water or less water. It was really a crapshoot. They had no idea what they were going to be dealing with. So
why do you think people stay in their homes as opposed to evacuating?
A variety, I'm sure.
Many of us, we're optimists. We think it's going to get better. You wake up in the morning and you look out and there's water in your street and it's up to the curb. And then and the boat, these guys come by in the boat, no, we're staying. We're fine. Because the electricity's on, the air conditioner's going at the house, and you're fine. Well, you know, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, now the water's 6 inches deep in your living room. Well, I think I want to leave now. You know, it's not, maybe it's not going to get better. So I think lots of folks we're optimists. I'm the same way. I always think things are going to get better. They won't get worse. They'll get better. If they don't get better, I'll make them get better. Well, I think many of these people were caught in that. They had no idea the magnitude. They were thinking, okay, it's going to stop raining and then the drains will take over and the water will go down. Well, that's not how it happened. I mean, the reservoirs from above, the water had to be let go from those reservoirs in their emergency spillways, because if they weren't, the dams were going to fail. And then these people would have been devastated. I mean, it would have killed maybe thousands of people. Mm-hmm. So they had no choice. They had to turn this water loose. Well, these folks had never dealt with that before. They'd never seen that before, even the ones who lived there many years. So I think we're just optimists and we think it's going to get better. And then when it doesn't, many times it's too late, you know, for some folks. So.
Yeah. This is Intersection on KBIA. I'm Sarah Shariari. Today we're talking with Missouri Task Force One members Terry Castle and Danny Mueller about that all-volunteer forces work in Texas following Hurricane Harvey. So for the two of you, you basically go through situations where, well, you did a dangerous job for many years. You still do a dangerous job. And then you're also on call to go into these dangerous situations. How do your families cope with that? I imagine if it were somebody related to me, I would be like, why are you doing an even more dangerous job now in your spare time?
Yeah, I think they know that we love it and it's ingrained in us. My wife's only known me as being someone that's been in the fire service. So it's been easy. It wasn't that I joined afterwards. So it's just part of us. It's part of my life. It's always will be. So, and I think that's how the majority of us are.
Yeah, and I think we instill in them that we're together. And so we're going to watch out for each other. And we're not going to, you know, we're not saying something can't happen, but we're trained to not only take care of you, but we're also trained to take care of each other first. And so that's my job. I'm a safety officer. And the last thing the fire chief says to the task force leader and the safety officer on the way out the door is 48 of them, bring 48 home. So that's a big responsibility for 13 days with all these folks and everything that's going on. But that's our responsibility. That's our job. And we're together. And we try to communicate back to them and let them have input when we can talk to them if we have cell service or use sat phones if we don't, so we can let these people call back and talk to their families and at least speak to them and say, we're okay, we're together, we're fine, we're, you know, we're not living in the Hilton or anything. we're sleeping on the floor in a gymnasium somewhere, and we haven't had a hot meal in 4 days, which happened to us, but it's okay because we're together, we're safe. So I think we just instill in them that our safe, that our training, and that we're together and we're watching out for each other. And I think they also, they feel a very much of a sense of pride of being part of this team also. It's not just the ones that wear the uniform. It's the ones that, the support people that stay at home, the folks, our employers, because our employers have to say, yeah, sure, you can go help out in Texas. So, you know, the folks that we work for in our everyday jobs, they're part of this team also. Our families are part of this team. So it's a big deal that there, you know, 48 of us went out the door, but there were 448 working on that team when you counted all the people back at Boone County Fire logistically helping us out, all of our families and all of our employers. So there's a lot of people on this team that don't always get to wear a T-shirt. Yeah.
And, you know, it got brought up in our very first briefing when we were in San Antonio. Our task force leader, Randy Sanders, he said, if you guys need anything back home, you need your yard mowed, you need groceries brought to your house, whatever, you let me know and I'll get it taken care of.
Yeah.
And he meant it wholeheartedly. And that's what happens. You know, my wife had so many people reach out on Facebook or phone calls or texts or whatever. And I know all of us did, you know, just, hey, what can we do to help? And that's very comforting when you're 1,000 miles away, knowing that if I need my grass mowed, that it'll get taken care of.
I think that's such a, I mean, maybe this is totally normal to you, but I'm thinking of sort of the situation of being in this place that's a complete disaster. It's like an alternate universe. And then you're thinking about home where there's like grocery shopping and lawns that need to be mowed. That must be a really strange two worlds to keep in your mind together.
Yeah.
It's comforting to us to not have to think about, not have to worry about those things, to know that someone's going to – I mean, the folks at Boone County Fire, when we're going on a two-week deployment, that the fire chief will come in one morning and say to the office staff, all right, call everyone's house, make sure everybody's – their families are okay. So we can send out a text that says, we talked to your family today, everybody's fine. So when we get in there in the evening and we get an email or we get a text that says, we called everyone's family, everybody's fine. That puts our minds at ease. We don't have to worry about home. Mm-hmm. We can worry about the task at hand. And I think that keeps us from being distracted many times.
And there are also the non-human members of the team. I really love dogs. How do you use them in your work?
We have live fine canines and we have human remains canines. Mm-hmm. So they're just like us. So they go with us. They sleep with us. They ride with us. They go everywhere with us. They are part of our team. And they are incredible, incredible assets to the task force with all the things that they can do. So fortunately, I don't think we used them too much on this deployment.
Not on this one. Then they ended up going to Irma and down to Puerto Rico, and they used them there at Puerto Rico. Yeah. But we didn't have to use the dogs where we were on the Texas deployment.
Have you experienced things? I mean, the Joplin tornado was a terrible disaster, and you've seen some other very difficult things. Is it hard to like recover a sense of normalcy after seeing these situations of total annihilation?
I think the hardest thing for us is, you know, your heart reaches out for the people that are affected. You know, we know that when we're out there, that when we get deactivated and start demobilizing and going home, we know that we're going back to a house and a family and everything, and I think that's what's hardest, is that you're leaving that, and they're still having to recover, and it's going to be an extended period of time before recovery actually happens. So that's what's the hardest. But getting back in the groove of things, I mean, it just takes a couple days just to get normalcy back.
I think Joplin might have affected me more than any of the deployments I've been on. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean to be cold, but the people in Joplin, they're our neighbors. Mm-hmm. They're from Missouri, you know. And so being 55 years old, you know, I played baseball in Joplin once when I was a kid. And my family are farmers, and my dad and grandpa, they bought bulls down that. I mean, so mm-hmm. you get to – there's connections. I mean, I know people who live in Joplin.
What do you think is – I mean, there are some people who do the type of thing where they put not only their lives out there, but they put themselves to, like, great inconvenience to do good things for other people. And this task force is obviously made up of people with that drive from many different backgrounds, you know, from medical backgrounds, from engineering backgrounds, from, like, public service backgrounds. What do you think brings all these people together, and where does that drive come from?
I think we all just have the same willingness to help our neighbor. You know, it that was instilled in me at a very young age to take care of people. And I don't think we really think about it necessarily. Mm-hmm. It's just what we do.
It's just a way of life.
So,
and I think we're very fortunate in this country to do that, to have many, many people that do that. Because I think about disasters that happen in other parts of the world. And they don't have this infrastructure,
right?
That this 28 task forces, or you know, the American Red Cross, or the Salvation Army, or all these other things that go in and help people in times of disaster. And I think we're just, you know, we have our problems in America. When we turn on the news, you'll see them tonight at 6. But I think we are also very, very blessed in this country that when something really bad happens, we put our differences aside. We put our political differences aside, whether we like the Cardinals or the Cubs or what. We put all those things aside, and we help our neighbors, whether our neighbors are across the street, across town, across the state, or across the country. You know, when people always said they were – and those folks in Texas kept saying, thank you very much. I just kept saying, you would have done the same for us. If this happened in Missouri, you'd be up here helping us. And they said, yeah, we sure would.
Thank you for joining us here on Intersection, Conversations in Our Community. And of course, thank you to our guests, Terry Castle and Danny Mueller of Missouri Task Force One. Our producers are Abby Ivory Gagna, Hannah Haynes, and Elena Rivera. Our music is Montana Skies. If you'd like to listen to this show again, visit us online at kbia.org. We also have pictures of Missouri Task Force One at work posted there. You can also like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, where we are at IntersectKBIA. I'm Sarah Shariari for Intersection, here on KBIA 91.3 FM.